Good afternoon. This is 91.3 FM KUAF in Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. And this is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, October 7th, 2020. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. On today's show, preparing for the general election, we learn how the University of Arkansas's Cooperative Extension Service is helping educate voters before they head to the polls. And in our latest installment of Reflections in Black, we learn about the life of politician and voting rights activist Stacey Abrams. Coming up after our show on Here and Now, as Vice President Mike Pence and challenger Kamala Harris prepare for their debate, we'll hear from the last man to debate Pence, Senator Tim Kaine. That's next time on Here and Now. Today at 1, right after Ozarks at Large. A record number of Arkansans have been hospitalized for COVID-19. The Department of Health reported yesterday 5 more people were admitted around the state, bringing the total number hospitalized to 529. In his weekly briefing on the pandemic, Governor Asa Hutchinson offered reassurances.
We do have adequate hospital space. There is sufficient room for the cases. We're not in a most difficult circumstance, but we want to see those numbers go down over time.
State Health Secretary Dr. Jose Romero said holiday gatherings were likely to blame.
What we're seeing, we believe, are the after effects of the large number of cases we saw around the Labor Day weekend. And this is what the governor was referring to, that for Halloween, for Thanksgiving, and for Christmas and New Year's, we can see significant waves of increased disease afterwards. I don't think it will continue. I think we'll see a decrease as this wave, if you will, passes.
ADH also reported 22 additional deaths yesterday from COVID-19. That brings the death toll to 1,321 confirmed cases, along with 148 probable deaths. There were 532 new cases of people testing positive for the virus. The latest report by a White House task force says as of last week, the state had the 9th highest rate of new cases. Washington County surpassed Pulaski County as the county with the most new cases yesterday. According to ADH, the top 5 counties with the most new cases are Washington County with 57, Pulaski County with 43, Benton and Faulkner counties with 27, and Sebastian County with 25. There are 5,970 confirmed active cases in the state, a decrease of 216 from the previous day. During yesterday's briefing, the governor also announced officials have revised guidelines for long-term care facilities. According to the update, expanded visitation may occur at facilities that have not had a newly positive case in 14 days, meet all staffing requirements, have adequate personal protective equipment, screen people entering the building, and restrict access to people who do not meet screening criteria. Minimum visitation at long-term care facilities may occur for medical treatment or in compassionate care situations if approved by the resident's health care provider. Hundreds of Arkansans continue to come down with COVID-19 on a daily basis. As Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek tells us, that's what one local family wants people to remember as they recover from the virus.
It really caught us all off guard.
That's Heather Holloway. And currently, she and 3 members of her family are in isolation because they've all contracted COVID-19.
My husband he lives separately, and he had come by the house and just seemed different than he had earlier in the day. And it seems strange that in just a few hours, I'd seen such a change in his like skin tone. He just seemed kind of cranky and like just not himself. And I kind of suggested like, maybe something's off. Are you feeling okay? He said, yeah, I'm just tired from work. It's no big deal.
But Holloway says when she woke up the next morning, she felt a lot like her husband did.
I pulled a couple of friends, and one of them that I trust just so much, who was very, very sweet, very helpful, but who said, hey, it's probably time to go get tested if you're not feeling good.
Deciding to get tested for COVID-19 came easy, but Holloway says actually getting the test was a bit trickier.
Where we could get tested on a Saturday, who would take our insurance, if that was something we were going to have to pay for. And my husband's test, he had already tested earlier in the summer and had no problems with that at the health department. But since that testing facility wasn't open, we weren't really sure where to go.
Eventually, the family went to a clinic with rapid testing, so they got their results back in less than an hour.
It was no time to wait, which was really great, but it was really bad news, which was positive. So we were really shocked. We really kind of thought we had done all of this properly. We thought we had taken all the precautions we needed to, and we've been just like everybody else, kind of on lockdown since the spring.
But Holloway says they had been easing back into some activities that involve going out into the world.
I'd ridden scooters. I'd sat on patios. I haven't eaten inside a restaurant. My comfortability level still isn't quite there. So we thought we'd done all this kind of right.
Holloway's 13-year-old daughter has also been learning virtually this school year, while her 22-year-old stepson graduated from Hendricks College in the spring and had decided to hold off on going to grad school this fall.
You know, when you've got students that hang out with other students, even though we did virtual, you know, my daughter still hung out with kids who are going to school face-to-face. My son, even though he's not in school this semester, he's still hanging out with students as well.
But she adds, they did those types of activities outside and while wearing masks. So it's not clear how her family became infected.
It's really scary. I think that it's passing a little more easily than we even took into consideration. And I felt like I was being an absolute fanatic about this.
Luckily, Holloway says they're all experiencing mild symptoms, although the brain fog is unlike anything she'd ever experienced before.
It's not like you walk in the other room and you forget what you came for. It's like you walk in the other room and you forget like who you are for just a minute. It's really wild. It's been a really strange experience with that. The headache was a telltale sign for us. Fatigue has been just worse than it's ever been.
Holloway's daughter, Marty, has also been experiencing some breathing difficulties, which she describes this way.
So we have a 16-pound cat, and she sits right where my lungs are, and so it basically feels like that all the time.
Marty says finding out about the diagnosis was scary at first because her mom has a condition they thought might put her at higher risk for developing complications.
It's scary just because the corona just like attacks your lungs and everything. It's already a very vulnerable part of all of us, but especially for my mom. And I just had no idea what was to come for us. But we found out, we talked to a doctor, and we're okay, and we're fine now.
The family will be isolating through this weekend. Marty and her mom say that's been an unusual experience in and of itself, but at least they have each other for company.
At least for me, I sort of have a social limit with some people. And so when I'm in a house with certain people for a long amount of time, we sort of get on each other's nerves, but it's okay. just how it is. But
I think we've done a really, really good job of, just cohabitating has been interesting and fun, but it's definitely been, we're trying to make the best of it. We're watching a lot of movies. We're mm-hmm. eating a lot of really good food. We had dinner delivered last night from Missouri. Somebody drove to Missouri to pick us up Fazoli's. And so, there's some definite perks to having really good friends and family that take really good care of us.
And since they were already limiting their interactions with others, Holloway says that made contacting people who they may have exposed to the virus a lot easier.
We really, we struggled to make a very long list, but those disclosures all went really well and really easily. We kind of joked that it felt kind of gross and it felt kind of scary to do it. At the same time, once you made the disclosure, it was totally fine.
Holloway says she wants her family's experience to be a reminder to others that COVID-19 is still spreading in the community.
Even masking and going in public some and doing those limited activities and going to school, I really think is almost too big of a risk right now. And I hate to say that. As someone who took the risk and failed or didn't have the desired outcome, I really think that it's hit Arkansas to the level that we were afraid that it was going to.
And she adds, people are still dying.
I have a good friend that passed from this earlier this week, and she was only 4 years older than me.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zuzanna Sitek.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Support comes from Malco Theaters, with locations in Rogers, Springdale, Fort Smith, Van Buren, and the Fayetteville IMAX Theater. Malco gift cards available at all locations and online at malco.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. Early voting in Arkansas starts October 19th, so there's still time to brush up on the candidates and issues that will appear on the ballot. Oftentimes, it can be difficult for voters to find unbiased information about an issue when they're trying to educate themselves prior to an election. That's where the University of Arkansas's Cooperative Extension Service comes in. Kristen Higgins is a program associate at the Public Policy Center at the U of A System Division of Agriculture. When I spoke with Higgins earlier this week, she said the center has contributed to voter education for a while, and this year is no different.
The Public Policy Center is part of the Cooperative Extension Service at the University of Arkansas System Division of Agriculture. And even though the name agriculture is in the title, we have a very long history of doing more than just agriculture. We've got, you know, people who specialize in nutrition, who specialize in exercise, family well-being, financial literacy, and youth leadership, adult leadership. So it's not just agriculture. It's not just gardening. And we're in the Community Professional and Economic Development Unit. And this whole unit exists specifically to help strengthen communities. So we fall within the whole extension mission of supporting communities, supporting the individual. And so back in the 1990s, there was a statewide ballot issue proposed to eliminate property taxes. And while eliminating property taxes sounds really good, you know, I don't have to pay this. This is great. But what do those property taxes go for? They pay for your police. They pay for your fire. In some cities, they pay for trash. In some cities, or counties, it pays for paving your roads, maintaining your roads. So there's a lot more to property taxes. Your school district is completely funded by property taxes. So if you took away your property taxes, it would affect your community. And though it sounds good, most people might not be paying attention to the ballot issues, especially in a year where it's the candidates, the presidential election. So many people are focused on that, or they're focused on governor or mayor or senator. I mean, so they're focused on these things. And research has shown that people who aren't aware of an issue tend to either vote no or skip it because there's that fear that they might make the wrong decision. So you see that drop off between the people who vote for governor and then the people who vote for ballot issues. There's thousands of people not voting. But in the 1990s, that was before my time, but my predecessors felt that, you know, it was really important to give people the information that they need to know about how their community is funded and about property taxes. And that kind of woke up some people to knowing that, okay, well, we're doing all this education about budgeting, we're doing all this information about community finances, but we aren't, you know, we're focused on the community leader and not the citizen. So we actually need to take a step back and provide the citizens some information so that they can better make decisions. Because voting in these issues, whether it's a city ballot issue, county, or state, can impact your life, your daily life in Arkansas. So it makes a big deal. So since 2004, we've been providing information about all of the statewide ballot issues. Again, providing a neutral information because you can go out there and find a lot of information about candidates, but oftentimes the only information you find about the issues are from either the supporters or the opponents. So we're providing that neutral information so that voters have what they need to make a decision and participate. We want them to participate.
The main piece of this effort that I'm familiar with is the website. Are there other types of outreach that you do to share this information with Arkansans?
Just like everything else with in the world, the website actually came later because the Extension Service has been around a long time. We've had our materials online at uaex.edu/ballot, but before the website came our voter guide, and we do still have a lot of information in print. We don't assume everyone has access to the internet. We don't assume that everyone wants to read something on a screen. So we still publish our voter guide, the same voter guide that you find on our website. You can go to your county extension office in any county across the state and pick up a printed voter guide. And, it's very helpful. It's got a worksheet in it that you can write notes on and rip it out and take it with you to go vote. Some notes on, okay, well, how did I want to vote on this issue? Well, I don't even remember what this issue is. Oh, let me look and see what I wrote to myself a couple of days ago. So yes, we have information in our printed voter guide. We have display boards across the state in various locations like libraries or courthouses, just to give people a reminder, a visual reminder that there are issues on the ballot. And we also have made several YouTube videos, so people can go out and watch a short 2-minute summary of the issue if reading about it isn't their thing.
So how many people are working on this project? It sounds like it's a lot of information to distill and share with people.
We could not have this voter guide if not for the cooperation of many, many people. So we communications department that helps with design. We have professors at the University of Arkansas viewing fact sheets because we want to make sure if we're describing something, a legal process, that we get it right. So they review it. We have supporters and opponents review fact sheets to make sure that it's accurate and neutral because wording matters. But the majority, the bulk of the work is done within the Public Policy Center. So that's me and my director. And if I'm lucky, I have another colleague who can help write all this information. But that's our job. This is what we do. We do a lot of analysis. We do a lot of research. And we try to take all that information and write it in a way for the public to understand. So we try to put it in a way without a lot of jargon, break down the terms and provide definitions for something because, not that this isn't any of the statewide ballot issues right now, but if you're talking about a millage, people first have to understand what a millage is.
In addition to the statewide initiatives, what is some of the other information that people can find out about voting? Do you cover more local pieces of what'll be a part of their election?
We do have a local ballot issue voter education program that's by request because our resources are limited. I'm one person, but we do work with, our county extension agents across the state if there's a local election. And there might be some interest from either it might be a county or a city or a group. We have had agents request us to do something very similar for their local issue. And that would be, just getting the ballot title and then answering some very basic questions. Again, something as simple as what is a millage, or when was the last time our sales tax rate went up, or if it's a wet dry issue, what's the status, or what are the status of the counties surrounding us? So we do some, but it's by request. So maybe about 5 or 6 a year. There's no way we could do every election, but it's helpful because, as a lot of people are aware, many communities might not have a newspaper anymore. So where do you go for that information?
Is there anything else we should know?
I just want people to, take some time to look over the issues and not wait until it's election day and they're standing in line. Because I've seen this, as a voter, I've seen this. I've been in line with in front of them, and I see them pulling up their cell phone and trying to find information while they're standing in line. These issues, again, they affect your daily life. If you pick up the newspaper, and you will see news article after news article about something related to a constitutional amendment. It might not say it in there, but I can trace a lot of them back to constitutional amendments. So these do impact your daily life. You know, you might not be a legislator. You might not be the one who's specifically impacted in the wording, but it eventually it can affect you. So just take that time and do that little extra bit of homework to look at these issues and make an informed decision.
Thank you so much for your time and all of your hard work on the research for this initiative.
Thank you.
That was Kristen Higgins, Program Associate at the Public Policy Center at the U of A System Division of Agriculture. I spoke with her earlier this week. You can find voter education information from the Policy Center at uaex.edu/ballot. The U.S. Supreme Court yesterday heard oral arguments in the case of an Arkansas law that seeks to regulate the ways pharmacies receive reimbursements from insurance providers. Daniel Breen from our content partner KUAR in Little Rock has more.
In 2015, the state legislature passed Act 900, which put stricter regulations on pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs. They negotiate the price for prescription drugs with pharmacies on behalf of insurance companies, which represent a large swath of the American workforce. Arkansas passed the law to help address one problem. PBMs were asking pharmacies to either sell certain drugs at a financial loss, or insurance companies would no longer cover drugs bought at their pharmacy. A group representing PBMs sued, saying Act 900 is in conflict with a federal law known as ERISA, which sets minimum protections for workers with many employer-based health insurance plans. Seth Waxman, an attorney representing PBMs, said that federal law was passed to prevent states from regulating insurance plans, which he says the Arkansas law does.
State regulations affecting an ERISA plan system for providing, processing claims, and paying benefits impose precisely the burden that ERISA preemption was intended to avoid.
But Arkansas Solicitor General Nicholas Brawny argued the state law has nothing to do with insurance plans, only with the price of certain drugs that are already covered.
You have to interpret that language in light of the remainder of ERISA and what ERISA actually is concerned with, which is the plan beneficiary relationship. And the things that are specifically listed in ERISA that are designed to ensure benefits are more secure, and Act 900 in no way regulates the plan beneficiary relationship.
Justices Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh cited Supreme Court precedent in asking whether Arkansas's law could be perceived as a violation of the federal law if it would result in higher drug prices. Brawny responded, saying not all insurance plans in Arkansas fall under that specific federal law, and that there's no guarantee PBMs would raise drug prices or that the state law would impact insurance companies' coverage decisions. In Little Rock, I'm Daniel Breen.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Walmart is launching a licensed insurance brokerage. According to a press release, Walmart Insurance Services, LLC, will begin selling Medicare insurance plans during this year's annual enrollment period, which is October 15th through December 7th. At launch, Walmart Insurance Services will provide Medicare plans offered by Humana, United Healthcare, Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield, Amerigroup, Simply Health, WellCare, Clover Health, and Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield. More carriers may be added in the future. The brokerage is licensed in all 50 states and Washington, D.C. $5 million is being awarded to 15 facilities across the state as part of the Arkansas Meat Processing Grants Program. The funding is provided by the Arkansas CARES Act Steering Committee and the Arkansas Legislative Council. According to the Arkansas Department of Agriculture, the recipients of the funding will help address the lack of local, small-scale meat processing capacity in the state that limited producers' ability to meet consumer demand for locally grown meat products during pandemic-related disruptions. Recipients include B&R Meat Processing in Winslow, JD Custom Meat Processing in Greenwood, and Keyes Family Butcher Shop in Van Buren. In 2019, Arkansas was ranked 10th in the nation in beef cow inventory. The Hunt family is giving a $5 million gift to support the Fayetteville Public Library's expansion project. According to the library, the donation will go towards the Center for Innovation and Gathering Glade. While services are still being provided, the library closed its building in late September as it entered the final phase of construction. The expansion project is expected to wrap up in late November. Fayetteville Film Fest has unveiled this year's lineup. The 12th annual festival, which will be presented online November 5th through the 14th, will feature 11 narrative and documentary feature films, along with 30 short films screening on demand to your home. Tickets and more information are available at FayettevilleFilmFest.org. Fayetteville Parks and Recreation is launching a new program called Outdoor Fayetteville. According to a press release, the program will offer participants the opportunity to learn outdoor recreation skills. Outdoor Fayetteville will launch with sunset paddling October 14th and 21st. Future offerings will include biking, hiking, backpacking, and camping. Programs are designed to allow for social distancing and small groups. COVID-19 safety precautions will be implemented. Osage Creek Bridge in Benton County is closing this week. Beginning tomorrow, Osage Creek Bridge on Old Highway 68, just west of Logan Road, will be closed as crews begin construction of the new bridge. County officials estimate the project will be completed by fall 2021. 12 new works of public art will be going up in cities across Arkansas over the next few weeks. The initiative, called Our Canvas, was launched earlier this month by Oz Art in partnership with the Unexpected Project out of Fort Smith and global curator firm Just Kids. Oz Art was founded in 2017 by members of the Walton family. The goal of the organization is to make art a part of people's everyday lives by putting it outside in public places. Elizabeth Miller, the art collections manager for Oz Art, says the pandemic has changed a lot of their plans for the year, but it's also what led them to this latest project.
We really wanted to put art outside where people could safely access it and where it can easily make a statement that everybody can get to. We were really looking at ways to celebrate the arts, support artists, and create some excitement.
Starting next week, the artists, who Miller says come from around the world, will begin putting up their works of art in Bentonville, Rogers, Springdale, and Fort Smith before heading to Central Arkansas to do the same.
And in Central Arkansas, we're hitting, you know, a wide variety of towns. We're hitting Conway. We're hitting Little Rock. We're hitting Hot Springs, but we're also going to be going to Pine Bluff. And we're going to try to hit a place like Stuckart, where we can really kind of take art to communities that maybe don't have it as every day part of their lives.
Miller says the artists will be creating pieces that stretch the boundaries of the traditional notion of murals.
Outdoor art is not just murals. And so we're doing some fully encompassing projects as well. So like in Hot Springs, we're having an artist who will paint the entire building. So it'll be a full immersion by the artist. And that artist is Camilla Walala, who has a piece in Fort Smith as well. And she's a British artist. But and then we're also, you know, doing silos and doing other interesting structures, but we're stretching the boundaries as well. We have artists who are doing billboards and vinyl works.
The theme of the initiative is Unite, which is a tribute to being united through shared outdoor and art experiences across the state. And Miller says they will be looking for involvement from local communities.
We are going to be making a call for volunteers. We're really looking at kind of engaging the communities as much as we can in these projects. Some of the projects will require volunteers to come help us paint. They're large projects that need everybody to kind of pitch in. But also the idea of, we don't want to just go to a town and plop an artwork down and then leave. So if we can engage the community, engage the residents, and really make it something that they're passionate about as well, is really what we're trying to do.
Volunteer opportunities will follow all pandemic precautions. Miller says they will be launching a virtual experience at ourcanvas.com. That's ourcanvas.com, and Oz Art NWA on Instagram that will feature videos of the art, artists, and communities. The Fort Smith Museum of History is shifting with the times. The museum was closed for 4 months because of the pandemic and is now open only on limited days and for limited hours. The changes mean financial challenges, and this week the museum is hosting a non-event to help make up for the shortfalls. Last week, Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums talked with Caroline Spear about the unmasked event scheduled to conclude Saturday. She says when the museum was closed, she was often the only person in the building checking on the well-being of the museum's collections.
For those very reasons, you come into work every day and you make sure that, if it's raining, that the basement's not flooded. Right. Because we have an issue with water that comes in from the basement. We're an old building. You make sure that, you know, there's not an air conditioner that's leaking or that's frozen up, or, you know, temperatures are fine, or that there's not been some strange you know, happening, the fuse blown that happened one morning. So yeah, if you're not here, you're not looking after the building. And if you're not looking after the building, then the artifacts aren't being taken care of. So absolutely. Bills don't stop, but the care that, and we look at the building, it's an artifact unto itself. It's a 1906 National Register building. And so you want to make sure that all things are operating and as they should be, so that artifacts are cared for and, you know, everything's still up and running when you do reopen.
All right. So coming up is this event called Unmasked. Don't worry, folks. They're not asking you to take off your mask and get inside. No. This is what you're billing as an unevent to help out the museum. How does it work?
Correct. So we decided to have a little fun with the Unmasked. And we even talked about, you know, does that send mixed messages? Because even before it was mandated, we required masks because when we did reopen, we see people from across the country every day. But we thought it would be fun to do a little play on that and talk about having the mask coming off. And really, that's our way of being very transparent about our financial situation. And what this is, it's called a non-event, and it's a virtual fundraiser. So what it is a way to donate money to the museum without actually having to come to anything. And our hope is that people will look at it, say if you were going to buy tickets to Party Gras, which is our major event of the year, you know, you might spend a couple hundred dollars on tickets, or if you're buying auction items, you know, you're looking at maybe a trip. So there are varying levels that we hope that people will consider in lieu of actually attending the event. And there are different levels. Say $50 covers most of our internet bill for the month. $100 to $500 helps purchase archival supplies and archival boxes, that kind of thing. So the different levels kind of give you an idea of where you would hope that your money goes to, so that we can spend it accordingly to our needs.
And all you have to do to participate is go to fortsmithmuseum.org?
Yeah, you can go to fortsmithmuseum.org. There is a page on there called Unmasked. So if you go to our website, you can find that. And you can apply right there. You can donate right there. And it gives you an idea of Unmasked is actually under, let me find it real quick, events. So you can go to our homepage and look for events, or you can go to the page itself and I can give you that web address. But either way, we'll take you to an Unmasked page. And it gives you at the bottom sort of the donation levels. So you can kind of get an idea of what you might want to consider. It's really easy. We've had our early campaign so far has brought us in almost $40,000.
Wow.
As of today. Yeah. Yeah. And this takes place on October the 10th. So we've set a deadline for it. And we'll be here that day. For phone calls, online, that kind of thing. But we've already had people who have called or sent in. We sent out some invitations to different people. So a lot of the invitations have come back in, and we're really excited about that. So our very early numbers are around 40,000 right now, and what we're shooting for is 100,000 right now. What that does is, our closure this year has been, we'll hit somewhere 60,000 plus mark in lost revenue. And so we're hoping that 100,000 is a good start, one, to replace what we've lost for the year, and two, to move into next year.
I'm wondering, have you had to shift any ideas about exhibits, when they might open, when they might close, when they might be available, how they might be researched? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. We had a large exhibition planned for now, for this time this year. It would have involved Marty Stauffer, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with who he is, but Wild America. So he's from Fort Smith. And we had already been in talks with Mr. Stauffer and his family and had a lot of things underway. But to bring him in and do, it was going to be a week-long of activities and programs and panel discussions and exhibitions, and going to be a great time. And we've had to completely shelve that for the moment. We've tentatively rescheduled it for next spring, but that even remains to be seen, because not only do we have to recover from this year, but we have to have the money to invest in what we're going to do moving forward. And that was going to be kind of our anchor for the fall. It's a partnership with 646, so we wanted to focus on art and photography. And so it's still there. It's just at a different time. But that was a hard one to have to think about rescheduling. It's huge. And we hadn't even really started publicity on it because we were still working on it. And so the public at this point doesn't even know what they're missing, because, you know, we've had to reschedule it. And then, yes, all of our fundraisers, our other smaller rotating exhibitions, everything just kind of got put on hold. We've picked up a little bit. We do have this fundraiser and our other fall fundraisers that are going on, and we've had one other event that was in-house that happened a couple of weeks ago, and that was kind of a test run. It was our first one since February, just to see how we could implement all of the safety precautions and make it work, and you know, what the response would be, that kind of thing. And it was successful, so that's a good start.
Those days when you were the only employee coming in, and there were those moments of aimlessness and you know, what's going on, what's going to happen. You're thinking about the frustration of having to cancel this big event. Could you look around in this building that's been open since 1910 and tell yourself, well, we've made it through depression. We've made it through women not being able to vote, through Jim Crow. We've made it through pandemics previously in wars. We'll get through this. Was there ever inspiration in your surroundings for you?
Oh, absolutely. And that's actually a really great point that you bring up, because that was part of it when you're just working and thinking of all the things that are just in front of you. And then you do wander because you do have to check out the building, and you come across artifacts, or you come across past exhibits that have been done, or you're looking at old documents, and it does strike you that, you know, this place has been around for 110 years and look what it's seen. And we were a hardware store before we were a museum. And we have ledgers of people, you know, who stopped in to buy supplies as they're going west, and, you know, things like that. So you are very tied to what you have been through. And it is a great inspiration, because for me, and I think for our board, our staff, the things we've talked about recently is, how do we change from here? And I think that's a very common, becoming a common and usual thought process for, I mean, everybody. But how do we make ourselves more accessible? How do we bring more of what we have to the public? So there's been a whole lot of talk because of that, as to what else we can do and where we can expand, and how we can push our mission forward in a different type of way. And that's because we're still working. Like, even when we opened, we came back, and there's myself and one other staff person here today. So that's a reduction from 7 people to 2. Mm-hmm. So that is also, so we have all these ideas of wanting to expand and move forward, and yet we're working on a reduced staff right now, which means everything is still in place. It just takes so much longer. So you do have to remember what your mission is and what your business has been through so that you can stay motivated.
Caroline Spear is the executive director of the Fort Smith Museum of History. The Unmasked event is Saturday, and more information can be found at fortsmithmuseum.org. She talked with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums last week.
This is Reflections in Black, and I'm your host, Raven Cook. Reflections in Black is a segment dedicated to exploring the legacy of Black Americans in the United States and around the globe. Reflections in Black also provides resources for understanding and hope for all people. Remember this in the darkest moments, when the work doesn't seem worth it and change seems just out of reach. Out of our willingness to push through comes a tremendous power. Use it. Stacey Abrams. Stacey Abrams was born on December 9, 1973, to Reverends Robert and Carolyn Abrams in Madison, Wisconsin. The family would spend a brief period in Mississippi before finally settling in Atlanta, Georgia. Abrams attended Avondale High Performing Arts School and was selected for a landmark summer program, which led to her being hired as a typist for a congressional campaign and a speechwriter at 17 years old. After law school, Abrams returned to Atlanta and worked as a tax attorney. At the age of 29, Abrams was appointed to deputy city attorney for the city of Atlanta. The role of deputy city attorney required leading a team of more than 20 attorneys and paralegals. Abrams would continue her work in public service as she was elected to the Georgia General Assembly in 2007, representing Districts 84 and then District 89. She would serve on numerous committees, including appropriations, ethics, and ways and means, just to name a few. In 2011, she made history as the first African-American minority leader of the Georgia House of Representatives. In 2013, recognizing the challenge of voter suppression in the United States, Abrams founded the New Georgia Project, which submitted more than 200,000 voter registrations between 2014 and 2016. In 2017, she resigned from the project to focus on her gubernatorial campaign. In the historic 2018 governor's race for Georgia, Abrams shattered another glass ceiling, becoming the first African-American woman in the United States to be a major party nominee for the office of governor. She ran against Republican Brian Kemp, the former Georgia Secretary of State, and although she lost the race 49% to 50, she refused to concede amid voter suppression tactics and concerns. Her campaign further filed a lawsuit and launched an organization called Fair Fight to change Georgia's entire electoral system. Always on the move, Stacey Abrams continues to pioneer as an award-winning author of 8 romance and suspense novels under the pen name Selma Montgomery. In 2018, she released the text Minority Leader: How to Lead from the Outside and Make Real Change. The recipient of numerous recognitions and awards, Abrams is the first ever Gabrielle Giffords Rising Star Award recipient and a lifetime member of the Council on Foreign Affairs. Today, we honor a true pioneer and a beacon of light in Stacey Abrams.
Reflections in Black is a production of KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville. You can hear weekly segments of Reflections in Black on Ozarks at Large, and you can hear past editions at KUAF.com. Just search Reflections in Black.
On October 29th, hundreds of handmade flags will flutter on the campus of the Eureka Springs Community Center. The Community Hope Flag Project aims to foster encouragement during a national crisis. Francisca Garcia Giri, who operates Flora Roja Acupuncture and Herbal Apothecary, is coordinating the flag project to buoy communities in isolation, she says, during the national COVID-19 emergency.
I was out one day and I saw some flags, some pretty little flags just flapping in the wind, you know, and it made me think of the prayer flags, and it just occurred that maybe that would be something that people could do. We could make these little flags of unity, these little flags of hope, and the idea was that we could just sort of, and they can sort of wave to our neighbors, our community, and say, hi, I'm here, and hey, I miss you, and hey, I love you, and or whatever that people wanted to express.
The public is invited over the next month to make flags reflecting their feelings and wishes, which are meant to be ephemeral.
You can use any material you'd like. You know, it can be a colorful or can just be, you know, just plain. I've been using just 100% cotton muslin. And then I've been drawing on them, some of them with Sharpie markers, and that's been really fun. But I've also beaded on some. I've sewed material on some. You know, these flags, once they're outside, they're not going to hold up. This isn't a permanent thing. This is just like a little prayer or blessing or set of intention, and then you let it, kind of let it go. Know that this isn't a permanent thing.
The flag project is being co-coordinated by Flora Roja Eureka Springs Community Center and the Eureka Springs School of the Arts. Kelly McDonough is the school's executive director.
Anyone who's interested in participating can either make their own flag at home, and there are instructions posted on the ESSA website and on the Eureka Springs Community Center website. Very easy. You don't have to be able to sew. There's lots of ways you can do it without having to sew. You can paint or draw something on your flag, a message, a picture. You can applique or embroider a flag, whatever you'd like to do. You can also pick up a blank pre-made flag at one of four locations in Eureka Springs. That would be at the Thursday Farmers Market, at Eureka Springs School of the Arts, at Flora Roja Community Acupuncture, or at the Eureka Springs Community Center. You can pick up a blank flag or flag to take home and decorate, and then when you're finished, you can bring your flag back to any of those four same locations to drop off by October 29th at 10 a.m., just any time before then, and then the flags will be hung at the Eureka Springs Community Center for everyone to enjoy.
The flags must have one edge folded, allowing an inch or so to create sewn or glued open hems through which twine can be threaded for display. Organizers of the Community Hope Flag Project invite residents from the county to participate and encourage other towns and cities to also create and assemble flags of hope.
Support for KUAF comes from the Walmart Museum on the square in downtown Bentonville. The museum and Walton's Five and Dime are temporarily closed. However, the Spark Cafe is open for walk-up service noon to 9 p.m. daily. More information is available at walmartmuseum.com.
This is 91.3 FM KUAF in Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Eureka Springs, a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas. Contributors today included Susanna Sitek, Kyle Kellums, and Jacqueline Froelich, who gathered information for the Community Hope Flag Project story. We also heard from Daniel Breen from our partner station KUAR in Little Rock. Timothy Dennis produced today's edition of Reflections in Black. He also mixed and mastered today's show. And our theme song is written and performed by Daryl Sean. If you've missed an episode of our show and you'd like to get caught up, or if you just want to share a specific story with a friend, you can find those past stories and editions of the show at ozarksatlarge.com. You can also listen to us as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of the program. Thanks again for tuning in, and have a great Wednesday.